Christchurch, New Malden, Sunday the 28th of June 2026. 11 o'clock service. Nathan Larkin speaking on The Practice of Evangelism by Brian Greene as part of the series Books by Our Forebears.
Books by Our Forebears. This is our final in the series where we have been looking at the lives and the things that have been written by people who went before us. And when I began to think about this, it got me thinking about moving into a new house. And it may be a house that someone else lived in for years, but we walk in thinking it's a completely blank canvas, empty rooms, a fresh start, yours to do what you want with it. But then you might slowly start to notice things. A shelf that is just in the right place. A plant that keeps reappearing every spring. You didn't put it there, but there it is. A cupboard that you never would have designed that way, but somehow it just works. And you realize that the previous owners must have known something you didn't. You're not starting from scratch. You're living inside something that someone else has shaped. Their decisions are everywhere, baked into the walls, for better, sometimes for worse. And churches like that. We didn't invent this place, we've inherited it. And yes, the way we do things may look very different now than it did 50 or 100 years ago. Maybe our music is different. Maybe the language we use to talk about faith is different, a different culture. But we might assume that means we're starting fresh, that we figured it out for ourselves, but we haven't. The way we pray, the way we think about faith, our instincts about what matters and what doesn't, none of it appeared from nowhere. It was passed to us by people who sat where you're sitting, who argued and prayed and got things wrong as well as getting things right long before any of us ever arrived. This is Christchurch there, sorry, on the screen. Just, a long time ago, and yet we can still recognize that that's where we're sitting now. And different doesn't always mean better. Some of what they knew, we may have quietly lost. Some of what they practiced, we may have drifted away from without ever actually deciding to. It just happened. And that's what's been so lovely about this series, learning from books by our forebears, not just that we can celebrate what we've inherited, but also we get a chance to ask honestly, what have we maybe lost? What have we been given? What could we build on if we were paying attention? And this morning, I want to introduce you to someone who would have stood here, almost exactly where I'm standing, about 100 years ago. He walked the streets of this parish, he visited people in their homes, he taught, he preached, lots of things that I do in my job today. He was curate here at Christchurch for 4 years, from 1924 to 1928. He was young, relatively unknown, and doing the unglamorous, mostly unseen work of parish ministry. His name was Brian Greene. This is him here, looking very young, as he would have been when he was here at Christchurch. Now, you may not have heard of him, but before he was finished, he became one of the most significant evangelical voices of the 20th century, speaking to tens of thousands of people across the world, in cathedrals, in universities, in stadiums, on multiple continents. But in 1924, he was here, just a young curate in New Malden. And then after decades of ministry and hard-won experience, he sat down and he wrote a book. This book, The Practice of Evangelism. And this morning, we're going to look at what he said. And we're going to ask what, if anything, it might say to us today. But to understand what Brian Greene wrote, it helps us to know a little bit more about him. And his own coming to faith, he describes as quiet. No big dramatic moment, no lightning bolt, more like a slow realization. It's clear that something happened, something tangible, but nothing spectacular. A turning, a trust. And out of it came an almost immediate desire to help people find the same thing. He was ordained, and in 1924, he arrived here. He was 23 at the time, energetic, and by his own admission, occasionally a bit too enthusiastic. But those 4 years in New Malden, he describes as being not very dramatic, but actually I think something happened here that tells you exactly who Brian Green was. You see, he wanted to start a children's group. And in those years, when you wanted to start a children's group, there was an obvious ready-made option called the Crusaders. Today, still exists, known as the Urban Saints. It was well-established, well-respected, and it was the sensible choice for a young curate wanting to hit the ground running. Easy to plug into, and it saves reinventing the wheel. But Crusaders at that time was only for boys. And Brian Green said, no. He walked away from the easy option and instead built something from scratch because he wanted the girls to be included. He called it King Zone, and it was open to both boys and girls. And in a 1920s church, that was really something. In fact, I think they're not here today, but we do still have members here at Christ Church who were part of that King Zone group. But it cost him convenience and probably some goodwill from people who didn't see why he had to make things complicated. And I think it really tells you something about him. Because before he ever wrote a word about evangelism, before the crowds and the cathedrals and the 100 transatlantic flights, he was someone who looked at a room and asked, who's missing? Who's not included here? He cared instinctively about who had access to the invitation. And he wasn't interested in evangelism just for some people. He wanted it for everyone, even the girls. And the amazing thing about King Zone, as I say, it outlasted him by decades. He was only here for 4 years. But the thing he built kept on running long after he left, into the mid-70s, when it was eventually replaced by Cypher. And as I say, we have people here who, when they were younger, were part of this group that he built. And you know, I think that's something worth sitting with, because sometimes it is the small, ordinary things, a decision about a group that's formed, a refusal to accept an unnecessary exclusion, maybe it's standing up for something that you believe is right, even when it makes your job or your life a little bit harder. But those little moments can turn out to be shaping something far bigger than anyone realized at the time. We never know what we're starting, but it's so important to do that right thing, even when it's more difficult. And then from New Malden, things developed and expanded in a way for Brian Green that would have been hard to predict from those quiet curate years. He went on to serve at Holy Trinity Brompton, and then later at St. Martin in the Bull Ring in Birmingham, where by that stage he had become so well known that on his first Sunday, word of his arrival got out and the congregation went from about 100 to over 1,000 people. He became known as an evangelist of extraordinary range, someone who could speak to students and to dockers, to cathedral congregations and university missions with the same conviction and the same warmth. He crossed the Atlantic over 100 times and he spoke on 5 continents. Billy Graham, who knew a thing or two about this, said that probably no foreign evangelist had more influence in America in his time. In fact, some people called Brian Green the Anglican Billy Graham and England's finest evangelist. And yet the thing that keeps striking me as I reflect on him and as I read his book is that despite all of these massive opportunities to speak to lots of people, he never stopped insisting that the real work was local, rooted in the ordinary parish, in ordinary Christians living ordinary lives. These big missions were a tool, but the parish was the soil. And then in 1951, after years of all of that experience, he sat down and he wrote it all out. And the practice of evangelism, it's not a theoretical book. It's not written by someone who studied evangelism from a distance and then came up with a system or a set of words to tell people about Jesus. It's written by someone who spent 30 years doing it and wanted to pass on what he learned. So, what did he actually say? Well, before I tell you a bit about what the book says, I thought I should make a little bit of a confession. Because, you know, for some of us, when we hear the word evangelism, it brings lots of mixed feelings. When we hear it, we might, you know, be thinking not so much of someone gently sharing something that matters to them. Instead, we might think of the pushy stranger on the high street with a megaphone, or the TV preacher promising that you'll have an easy life if you accept Jesus and, of course, send your money to them, or the door knockers handing out tracts about how sinful you are, trusting that shame will somehow lead you to God, or the sense of being manoeuvred into a decision that you didn't ask to make. And if that's the association, then embarrassment around the word evangelism makes sense. A lot of Christians are embarrassed by how evangelism has been done before, and sometimes still is now. And so when I picked up a book that I knew was written in 1951 called The Practice of Evangelism, I have to be honest, I already had decided what I was probably going to find there. I expected a very old-fashioned model, heavy on getting people to make a decision about Jesus, light on relationships and love, the kind where, you know, someone corners you after a meeting and asks you if you've accepted Christ into your heart and you're not quite sure what that means, but you feel you probably should. I expected to find it interesting in a historical way, but then to explain to you why we know better now and we do things differently. I would have hopefully been generous about it, of course, charitable, maybe thought he was a product of his time, but remarkable for the era. But then I actually read it, and as I did, I was very challenged, and I had to sit with something that C.S. Lewis once called chronological snobbery. This quiet assumption that older means less wise, that we know better now, that the direction of travel is always progress, that we have naturally arrived at the better understanding than those who went before us. Because when I read the book, what I found in Brian Greene was not a man that I'd outgrown. I found someone who cared deeply about people, who prayed for them regularly, by name, not vaguely, specifically with real people in mind, who loved the people he served and talked to, and who warned against the anxious evangelism, as he calls it, that tips into manipulation. He said that coming to faith is often gradual, not dramatic, but insisted that before you share anything of your faith, you have to genuinely care about the person you're talking to. Really care, not as a project, but as a person. He wrote, "The proper posture is a deep and open concern for the lives of those among whom we live," which is something very different, he said, from proselytizing, the pushy, agenda-driven version that makes people cross the street rather than engage with you. And the concern he describes is real and costly, but not anxious or controlling. Because ultimately, he says, this isn't our work that we're trying to do. It's God's work that we are getting involved in. We're getting involved in something God is already doing when we evangelize. And that's not what I expected to find in a book written in 1951. In fact, that sounds, if I'm honest, a bit like what we aim to be in our approach to evangelism. As I said before, you know, for some people, even not even evangelism, even just words like decision or making a response, when they hear those words come up, some people hear alarm bells. And as I said, that is understandable given some things that have happened in the past. People have heard stories or been part of, you know, that version that went really badly wrong, where emotion was deliberately stirred up to get a reaction, where the atmosphere made it harder to say no than yes, where people walked away having made a commitment that they didn't really understand and felt manipulated rather than invited, where sharing faith became less about love and more about closing a deal. Now, that is real, and it's important we name it, that that damage has been done. And being wary of it isn't weakness, it's wisdom. But here's the thing. Rejecting what is wrong in putting pressure on people should not be the same as avoiding offering an invitation to follow Jesus. The answer to manipulation isn't silence. Because if we look at the story of evangelism in this country over the last 100 years, you can see a movement. There were seasons, particularly in the 19th and early 20th centuries, where these massive, large missions, big gatherings, dramatic calls to respond were the main currency. Huge events, public moments, clear, sometimes intense invitations to decide for Jesus there and then. And I don't want to fall into the chronological snobbery about that either. That has, many, many people's lives were transformed by those missions, and God used them in amazing ways. But over time, there came a growing and largely often justified discomfort with anything that felt coercive or manipulative in evangelism. And churches began to emphasize relationship, trust, the idea that faith is a long journey rather than a single moment, meeting people where they are rather than pressing them towards where we want them to be. And then more recently, in churches that are often a bit like ours, we've leaned really further into that sort of welcome and belonging, creating space for people to explore at their own pace without pressure. And the idea that you can belong before you necessarily believe anything in particular. Now, I think in most ways that's been a really good development, but I do wonder, having read this book, I've felt challenged, and I'm asking this of myself as much as anyone. I wonder if in learning to walk alongside people so well, we've become less sure about how to help them take the next step. Whether in our entirely understandable desire not to pressure or shame or exclude, we may have become so gentle that we're not really offering an invitation to follow Jesus at all. And this is what Brian Greene is so helpful in his book. This is what I find to be really refreshing. Because for all that careful, patient, person-first concern, the part that sounds so much like us today, he holds on to something that we may have become less confident about. He really believes that in that journeying with someone, somewhere in that long relational journey with them, that there is a moment that comes, a point where someone moves from circling around faith to really stepping into it. From, you know, I find this quite interesting, to I trust this is true. From considering Jesus to following him. And he describes it simply not in a dramatic experience, but as a quiet turning. Something that could be as simple as, Lord, this is the way I am. Can you just help me to find you? It may be that and no more. No performance, no pressure, but a real personal response to a real invitation. And he believed that that moment mattered. That helping someone reach it, not pushing them to it, but not leaving them guessing either, was one of the most loving things we could do for the people around us. And if we look at those two passages we heard read this morning, they say something really important about all of this. In Isaiah 55, we read, "Come, all who are thirsty, come to the waters. And if you have no money, come and buy and eat. Come and buy wine and milk without money and without cost." And later it says, "Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call on him while he is near." Jesus made it even more explicit in John chapter 10. He says, "I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." Now, if you just take in the tone of that for a moment, this is not a God who is reluctant or hard to reach or waiting to catch us out and tell us off. This is a God who's leaning forward to us, saying, "Whatever you're carrying, whatever state you're in, whatever you think disqualifies you, come. I'm here, I'm waiting. No price, no barrier, no shame, an open, extravagant, almost embarrassingly generous invitation. But, and this really matters, it's not vague. It's not wander in the general direction of something spiritual and see how you feel. It's not pop along on a Sunday and see if it cheers you up coming to church. Look at Isaiah's verb, come, seek, call. These are active words. They ask something of us. And the offer is completely free, but a gift still has to be picked up. Jesus makes it sharper. He isn't offering principles to improve your life or a community to belong to or ideas to explore. He's offering, in his own words, life, real life, full life, the kind human beings are made for, that we may only catch glimpses of and spend the rest of our time searching for in other places. That's an extraordinary claim. He says he is the way to that life. It's an exclusive claim, which might not sit very comfortably with modern instincts that want all paths to be equally valid. But Jesus says, this is the way to life, I am it. And Christianity stands or falls on that. Either it's true or it isn't. But if it is true that Jesus is the way to life, and I believe he is, If he really is the way to life to the full, then sharing it isn't an imposition. It's the most loving thing we can do. A gate stands open and no one should be pushed through it, but at some point, they do have to step through it. So, reading Brian Greene, I've had to ask a hard question of myself and perhaps of us as a church. Not about the care. I hope I care for people well, and I hope we as a church do that fairly well. There's always room to grow. But yeah, this church is usually very good at welcome, warmth, walking with people through hard things, at making space for questions without people feeling judged for asking. But that other half, that part where Green wouldn't let go of, are we confident enough in what Jesus offers, what Jesus claims? Are we confident that it really is full life, the thing that people are actually searching for? And are we confident enough to help someone take a step towards it when the moment comes? Not to push or pressure, but to be brave enough to say, I think you might be ready. The door is right there. You don't have to stay outside. Because here's the thing. You can walk alongside someone for years, genuinely caring for them, and never give them the one thing they actually need. Someone to clearly say, this is real. God is for you, and you can know him. Green put it well. He said the thing that we most need is to recognize when someone is close, when the questions shift from curious to urgent, when someone isn't just interested, but is standing right at the edge of stepping in. And in that moment, the loving thing isn't to back away out of politeness or embarrassment, but to gently, clearly invite them to take that step. And that takes courage. It takes paying attention. It takes actually believing that what's on the other side of that door is worth stepping through for. And so here's what I want to say as we finish to those of us who do follow Jesus. We can pray for people like Brian Greene did. Not vaguely, specifically praying for them by name, knowing their needs, knowing who they are. Pray for that person at work that you've been meaning to invite somewhere. For the friend who keeps asking questions, the family member who started coming to church but hasn't quite crossed the threshold, pray for them, care for them, walk with them. And when that moment comes, when you sense they're close, when the question is live and the door is visible, don't leave them standing outside it alone. We're not trying to grow the membership of a club or recruit people to our tribe because, hey, it's nice to have more bodies in church on a Sunday. It's just that we actually believe when Jesus said he was the way to full life, that he was telling the truth. So let's be brave enough to name it and gentle enough not to force it. You don't need a program to invite them to or a script of the perfect words. We just need to care enough to say something. And if you're here this morning and faith is something you're still circling, still exploring, still not really sure what you think, then let me speak directly to you. Because you are genuinely welcome here. That's not a line we say to make you feel more comfortable. You are. Your questions are taken seriously. And you don't have to pretend to believe things that you don't. You can take all the time you need. But I also don't want to leave you thinking that it doesn't matter whether you ever respond. Because it does. Not just to us. We're not keeping score. It matters to you. Jesus isn't offering a philosophy to consider or a community to try out or a set of ideas to weigh up indefinitely. He's offering life. The kind Isaiah describes where the thirsty actually get to drink, where what you've been searching for turns out to be freely available all along, where you don't have to keep standing outside wondering what's on the other side. That offer has your name on it. And at some point, it becomes something you should step into. Not with everything figured out or with every doubt resolved, just with trust. A quiet turning towards the God who's been leaning towards you all along. And if you're there, or even close, don't drift past it. And one day, maybe in another 100 years' time, someone else will stand here where I'm standing. And they'll look back at us the way that we have looked back on Brian Greene this morning. And maybe they'll ask the same questions. What did they believe? What did they do with it? Did they take it seriously enough to pass it on to other people? Brian Green started here. 4 years, it's not a lot, as a young curate, in an ordinary parish, mostly doing the invisible work that a curate does. Making a small decision about a youth group that turned out to matter for decades and decades and impact hundreds of young people. And from here, something grew that shaped thousands of lives across the world. He wasn't perfect. In many ways, I'm sure he was a man of his time. But he held on to something that we need to hold on to as well. The conviction that the gospel, this good news about Jesus, is genuinely good news, worth sharing, worth the awkward conversations every now and then, and the courage and the long, patient work of relationship. He didn't offer in his book a method to copy or a program to run, but he did challenge us to recover a posture, a deep and open concern for the lives of those around us. So walk with people, pray for them, care for them. Pay attention to where God is already at work and where we may be able to join. But when that moment comes, be brave enough not to miss it. Because love walks with people, but love also tells the truth about the next step. And may we be a church that does both.